Hello and welcome to this week's The Proteomics Show. This is the Oregon Trail, season 3 of a special limited series sponsored by US HUPO.
Hi, I'm Ben Osborne, and I'm here with Dr. Benjamin Mealy. And this episode features Dr. Mark Flory, who is a senior scientist at the Knight Cancer Center within the CDER at the Oregon Health and Science University in Portland.
Right, first Portland person. And he had a really cool history, you know, getting to where he's at, broadly just applying technology to answer biological questions, but also the best iHupo souvenir ever. So enjoy. All right, hello and welcome to this week's show, Mark. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Now, you are one of the few guests that actually another guest had talked about. So I think you know Parag Mallick? Do you know this
person? Oh, yes, Parag, yes.
Parag. God, I keep wanting to call him something else. Apologies if he's listening. So you know him, right?
Oh, yes. I worked in his lab a brief bit when I was down in the San Francisco Bay Area, and we were actually postdoctoral colleagues together in Rudy Ebersol's group at the Systems Biology Institute back in our Seattle days, quite some time ago. But yeah, we've stayed in touch, and he's a fantastic colleague in the field and a great friend as well.
Cool. No, that's, I wanted to make sure that I made that connection for anyone who's been listening. And you're not in Seattle or San Francisco or LA. You are in?
In between. So Portland, at Oregon Health and Science University, specifically in the newish, in about, 6 years old now, Cancer Early Detection Advanced Research Center, known as CEDAR, which we focus on cancer early detection, and we're part of the Knight Cancer Institute here on the lower campus, the waterfront campus of OHSU.
But it sounds awesome. So we're going to ask you lots of questions about Portland. But first, we have people on because they are coming to the upcoming conference and they're giving a talk. If you don't know what you're talking about, that's cool. But would you, if you do know, or you just want to talk about like a little bit like what you do, or maybe what you're going to be talking about, up to you.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. So I was originally trained not as a proteomics person, as a cell biologist and geneticist at the University of Washington, Seattle. And after that, did the postdoc with Rudy Ebersold, where I got to know Parag and several other now luminaries in the field in many ways, Anne-Claude Gingras, the University of Toronto, Baron Bullscheid, many others. It was a really fantastic group to work with at that time at the Systems Biology Institute. And it was a great opportunity to be in Rudy's lab. Really what I focus on now versus then, which was really applying proteomics to molecular biology problems to figure out how molecular machines work, whether it was spindle pole bodies, centrosomes, or telomeres, really now sort of have transferred over to applying mass spectrometry-based proteomics to different types of problems. And I like the variety of types of problems that, you know, I've been faced with, and I've continued to do that in the Bay Area, in various contexts, even at an ag company, at an immuno-oncology company in Parag's lab, and now up here in CEDAR, working on cancer early detection. So really, if more focused on the technology side and how to get the best answers we can for sometimes projects that we're driving, but often projects that others are driving and know the biology for. So I get to ride their coattails a little bit on it and enjoy the biology vicariously. As I help as much as I can to apply the proteomics technology to get to the endpoint that they're looking for.
So it sounds kind of like you've got a center. Is that kind of your design of your lab?
So CEDAR's kind of an unusual architecture. It's a flatter architecture, if you will. Although I think our head Sadek Esner doesn't really like that term, but it's probably the best way to convey how it works. We have philanthropic funding from Phil and Penny Knight, and of course the taxpayers also contributed and OHSU matched. And that basically is dispersed in a format where we form projects around an idea. It's kind of almost a DOD type funding mechanism where it's, you know, you form a team, you have a kind of fast fail paradigm. And you have milestones and deliverables along the way. If that proceeds, that can move on to an incubator space where potentially a company could be formed, maybe IP is collected, or it proceeds, sort of expands into a larger project that might be something that we would go for external funding for. So we do have faculty members who have more of a traditional group, and they run sort of their group with trainees in terms of postdocs and graduate students. So it's a bit of a hybrid model. It's somewhere, it feels, I'll say, being here now, somewhere in between a traditional academic environment and the biotech environments that I've been in. Somewhere in the middle on the spectrum, I would say, in terms of how things work. In our group, we focus on mass spectrometry-based proteomics. We have a timsTOF 2 that we're now in the process of upgrading to the HT format. And we were the first in the world, we always like to say this, to implement the Seer Proteograph platform and really do a lot of experiments now with the Seer Proteograph and then feeding outputs from that into the timsTOF. So we have several studies ongoing, one that I'll talk about at HUPO, which is a scale study, almost 1,000 patient specimens, where we're looking to find blood proteomic markers as PSA reflex markers. Given that PSA is really the traditional standard of care for prostate cancer screening, it has high sensitivity, but not necessarily good specificity for cancer. You can ride a bike or have prostatitis, not cancer, and have elevated PSA. So we would like markers that more specifically define that you actually have something worthy of going in for a biopsy, because I know I've not had one, but I have colleagues who have, and you don't want to have a prostate biopsy unless you really need one. So that has been a big focus of ours, but we also have some other projects as well ongoing and in planning stages for the Proteograph and timsTOF.
Wow. Okay. I can kind of feel like I can formulate from context clues what a fast fail paradigm is, but can you elaborate on that?
Sure. So when we build a project out, when we propose a project and construct a proposal, there's milestones and deliverables, and they actually like those typically to be quantitative. So, for example, for small input mass spectrometry, can you hit, an ID rate of X and a variance rate of Y for a given number of cells? That would be an example. For our Proteograph preps, do you get so much microgram returns from the Seer Proteograph assay? And then, how does that end up in terms of protein ID rate? Sometimes if it's a method development project, it will be developing a method, whether it's gas-phase fractionation or something else. And then you set some sort of milestones for that. So it's much less, as I heard a nice talk, sort of defining different types of proposals, much less a hunting license where you come up with an idea. You might find the white rhino versus the tiger and you can go chase the white rhino. In this case, you're really tethered to what your original plan was in terms of milestone deliverables. If you find something serendipitously, you can also always build out another project around that, but you wouldn't be able to use the initial project's funding for that. So it aims to keep the scientists and researchers on focus with their initial mission. In that, if it's not a successful path, and then start another one.
Oh, okay. So are you professional scientists, or do you have students there, or is later career people in general?
Yeah, so I'd say it's a broad spectrum. So we have senior scientists like myself who often have, been in a number of different types of positions. I've been in academia, was a faculty member at Wesleyan University for a stint out in Middletown, Connecticut, have been in two philanthropic centers now for science research, and have been in industry positions as well. So I think, we're bodies of knowledge, somewhat long in the tooth, but bodies of knowledge that people can reference, and also bodies of experience. There's a lot of trainees that we have in terms of graduate students and postdocs are very interested in hearing about what was life, at least as I experienced it and others have experienced it in the biotech world, outside Portland. Some people are from Portland and, haven't lived elsewhere. So I think, we serve in a scientific capacity in terms of knowledge, but also sort of experience over life, sort of what our training and different job types have been like, and even what it's like to live in different areas of the country. I've done a fair amount of that as well. So, and then in between we have, RAs, technicians. I would say our faculty in general are on the more junior level of the body of actively researching scientists. And then we have what are known as distinguished scientists who are often toward the end of their career, but very experienced, have done, you know, great things in their career and are now really more in a mentoring capacity for, you know, folks like myself and also for the more junior faculty and the trainees as well. So spans, I would say it spans the gamut. We do have some folks, one senior scientist that I can think of right now who was very heavily involved at upper levels in industry. So yeah, all sorts of experience types. A lot of engineers as well. You know, Sadek, our head, is an engineer by training and in the way he thinks. And we have a pretty large cadre of engineers building things, microfluidics, devices, and so forth. So that's always interesting for me. That's not something I've done. I think it's super cool and interesting to learn about. So I often wander down to that end of our floor on the fifth floor to see what they're doing.
So, I mean, I know we were probably supposed to talk to you more about like science and we'll still get there, but like, I'm really interested to hear about this place. And, you know, because I think as scientists, like we get stuck in like our little world, unless we've bopped around everywhere. I mean, you said it feels kind of like a DOE national lab of sorts, but like how, so it's philanthropic, but are you still then like applying for internal grants, you know, like not the hunting license, like, or how does that part work? Is it external, internal? We don't need to go super deep, but I want to know.
No, sure. I think it's an interesting question because I think everybody, we have a position that's called the sort of coach mentor, and I'm one of these coach mentors. And everybody asks this sorts of question when they come in, you know, if they're not super clear on it when they come in. So, yeah, I mean, we have different mechanisms for funding. One is sort of the CEDAR Fund, which is our philanthropic pod. And that's kind of the very directed, you know, milestone deliverable type proposal. We also can, as it depends on the position that you're in, faculty, for example, you know, have to for their career progression and have more autonomy, right, for external grants, R01s and so forth. I am not allowed to do that since I'm not a, you know, traditional faculty member, but I can be a co-PI on grants with faculty members. So, for example, to partially defray costs of our timsTOF, I wrote a proposal with Gordon Mills here, who was the official PI on the grant, to get a Murdoch trust to help pay for our timsTOF purchase. So, it's kind of a mixed bag of all types of different types of funding. We have also an ACE funding mechanism that uses CEDAR funds and other funds and allows us to collaborate with a set of centers in the U.S., Stanford, and also a number of U.K. centers as well. So that's another funding cycle that we watch out for as well, the ACE funding cycle.
Cool. Yeah, no, it's you know, I mean, I've, like you, you know, I've been in academia and now I'm in this place where like, we're basically, I'm a line item. And then, you know, I have friends that like, are in DOE labs and like, they're there, but then they have to like cover all their salary. And so but I think it's always interesting to hear how these things actually work because there's a ton of diversity and I think people don't realize that. So,
yes.
All right. So at this part of the show, we like to get into like how you got here. And I know you just mentioned offhand a ton of fun things. So I want you to get into that part of your story, but even kind of like before that, you know, like why did you become a scientist as far back as you want, or, you know, what was that interest in molecular biology, however you want, but
sure.
Definitely mention all the bopping around between.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I've definitely been a bit of the itinerant scientist, which is sometimes hard, moving a lot, but it also gives you a lot of background, different types of experiences. If we go way back historically in my life, back to Southwest Virginia, where I grew up, my father was he had the traditional faculty job. He was at a small liberal arts college, all women's college, about 1,000 students for about 48 years, the same position all the way through. So he's always mystified by my moving from position to position and moving and so forth. What are you doing?
What school is that?
Different generational experience. I had a ton of fun. He was an experimental psychologist and, you know, way back even before, you know, all the digital age, was wiring relay racks and so forth for, you know, the pigeons and rats and so forth for response experiments. And I get to sit in there and work with him and play with stuff. And I think, you know, I've always probably naturally been a tinkerer and like to build. I still do lots of woodwork and building things. So I really like working with my hands and thinking about how things work and putting things together and sometimes taking them apart and not being able to put them back together. So I think that's probably, you know, a large basis for, you know, my becoming a scientist. I started out in sort of that same vein in my undergraduate work at the University of Richmond in Virginia. Spiders. If you are an NCAA fan, occasionally they're one of the Cinderella teams. That's kind of only the only way people know about University
of Virginia. Wait, somebody, University of Virginia is called the Spiders?
No, the University of Richmond.
Richmond is the Spiders?
The Spiders, yes. I believe it's the only school still that has a spider as the mascot, and it's a big furry spider that jumps around at basketball games. They occasionally beat, you know, highly ranked teams in the NCAAs, and that's what people, you know, occasionally are like, oh, the Spiders basketball. That's kind of what people know them for. They have actually developed a lot academically. You know, they were under the radar when I was there, and I think, you know, have really become, you know, a real opportunity for people now. Anyway, I started out in psychology there and then just got very interested in molecular biology courses that I was taking there. And that kind of shunted me into molecular biology, biochemistry, even some analytic chemistry. Surveyed graduate schools across the country, fell in love with the Seattle area and the offerings there. So ended up at the University of Washington in their umbrella program, molecular and cell biology. Ended up in the Department of Biochemistry, working on yeast and human cell centrosomes and spindle bulb bodies. And that was just a fantastic time in my career, being able to do genetics, molecular biology. A lot of those molecular screens were time consuming. And at the time, John Yates and Rudy were at UW and giving kind of amazing talks on how fast you can get to components of protein complexes, look at protein expression with proteomic mass spectrometry, which was really coming onto the forefront. This was the end of the 1990s. And I was just blown away. At the time, Lee Hood had spun off or was just about to spin off the Institute for Systems Biology from UW. Rudy went with him. At that time, so right as Rudy was sort of, you know, his last days at UW before going to ISB, I talked to him and we worked out a postdoc. So, and then really it's tracks on what I've told you before, sort of, you know, getting more and more heavily into the technology and how to apply that to answer different questions, whether it's in biotech or to help people with their research programs. I've really enjoyed that. It gives a lot of variety to the types of, you know, whether it's trying to find biomarkers in blood, as I'm doing now, or we look at protein complexes for different cellular processes, a project on that, looking at, you know, expression in spatially resected tissues that we have a lot of here in our biorepository, because we're, of course, a hospital here, medical center. So lots of FFPE samples always at the ready. So that's a really nice thing to have. And I'd say at OHSU, one of the huge advantages that I found here is that we have clinician researchers who are really involved in being involved in the research. They often don't have a ton of time to do research because they've got a lot of clinical responsibilities, but they are really motivated and, you know, make themselves accessible. And you know, it's great. And it's great to have access to them, get their input, you know, expertise on experimental designs to dovetail those with clinical unmet need and so forth. So I think that's been a real advantage here, in addition to the sort of interdisciplinary nature of CEDAR.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. You mentioned the clinical unmet need. You know, I worked at a medical university, and like we had this really cool like panel for late stage prostate cancer, and then like we showed it to a surgeon. He's like, "But why do I need this? Like, this is right." But I think that's the thing. Like, we can get stuck in this weird world where, like, we're just like academics. We made biomarkers, and then you go talk to someone. They're like, "Dude, I don't need that." But like, versus this prostate cancer or PSA assay that's better than PSA because hey, it's not the best marker, right? Or it could be better. So, when all these companies happen, like in the story, so are these just like spinoffs at the same time? Or are you like switching full time?
So are you talking about the companies here at OHSU or the ones that I've worked at or?
Yeah. You like, so you had mentioned okay, like yeah, so, companies.
Yeah. After Rudy's lab, he headed to Zurich to take a position at ETH. And about that time I was looking around for faculty positions, ended up at Wesleyan University in the molecular biology and biochemistry department. Really enjoyed that, you know, enormously there, teaching across the spectrum, everything from relatively large introductory biology classes, which has its own challenges, you know, up to the upper undergraduate courses, which I think were kind of the sweet spot. You had really interested students, you'd kind of funneled them down to the ones that really were into the science aspect, wanted to hear about, you know, new stories of molecular biology, you know, how things work, even experiential stories for me. And also we had a small PhD program, often drawing from international students. At the time, the funding rates, you know, were pretty dire. I don't know if they've gotten a lot better for the study sections that I was in. But I think a couple of faculty members had been successful in getting R01s. At a school that size is pretty remarkable. And the expectation, you know, fair or not, was that everybody should get an R01. So I, at that point, was kind of at the midpoint, a little bit beyond midpoint. And it was, you know, the mantra was no R01, no tenure. So mass spec and proteomics moved so quickly, I was a little worried about, you know, sort of how that was going to work out. If I didn't get tenure, you know, you're that much more out of date with mass spec. I had my own mass spec there, but of course, you know, you have to cycle them every five or so years to stay current. We also, and I say we, my partner, Amy Sanchez, and I missed the West Coast a lot. So, you know, the East Coast has a lot of great things, but the West Coast is its own thing. And we had met in Seattle and really wanted to get back to the West Coast. So I decided, you know, all right, well, I will give the industry thing a go. And that would prompted our move back to the West Coast, in this case, the San Francisco area. So started out, you know, sort of getting my foot in the door in that space at an ag company, Mendel Biotechnology. They were doing focused on transcription factors in Arabidopsis, needed somebody to develop methods for chromatin IP and IP mass spec in plants. Definitely a new foray for me and a lot of fun method development. You know, getting protein extracts out of leaves and stems is definitely even harder than yeast. So there was a lot of method development there. We had some really good successes getting CHIP to work, Illumina ChIP-seq on transcription factors in plants, and then some success. So we didn't have our own mass spec. We were farming that out. Some success with IP mass spec. Then moved on to a startup company working on immuno-oncology antibodies as therapeutics. And we pivoted to ADCs at that point, kind of a couple years in to my joining the company. This was Igenica Biotherapeutics. So I ran the discovery platform wing there. We analyzed really thousands of surfosome samples, doing surface bioattenuation of cell lines, dissociated cells from xenografts and primary tumors, all sorts of comparators, a whole bevy of indications. We were running on thermo instruments at the time, Orbitraps, not the newest ones that we have now. Of course, this was several years ago. And then when we did ADCs, I sort of got a taste of the CMC world. We did have purified ADC therapeutics that we needed ADC drug ratios done for. So I entered the realm of top-down mass spec, native and denaturing top-down. With a Waters instrument, again, new stuff, developed all that, got that working, and sort of fed the conjugation wing and the CMC wing of the company, looking at those purified therapeutics as well. So big adventure. That eventually, unfortunately, did not make it, you know, along the way. I think we were maybe five or probably longer than that, probably 7 or 8 years in. And at that point, I went to work for Prague for a little while at the Canary Center, just in talking with him, as I often do, you know, he said, oh, come down and you can play with our triple quad. We have a new triple quad and mass spec, and it would be great to have an instrument, you know, a more experienced experimentationalist in the lab. So instrumentationalist experiment person. So I did that for a bit and got to know a director there who was moving up here to oversee CEDAR. And that was kind of my connection to getting involved with CEDAR. And this brought Amy and me kind of full circle back around to the Northwest again, where we thought we would probably just retire at some point, but this position arose. So we thought, well, we can go back earlier. Houses aren't going to get any cheaper, so might as well do it now. And so here I am.
Man, what a path, you know?
It is. It's probably a longer raging path than a lot of people have, but
yeah,
it's given me a lot of, I think, experiences and seeing how things work in different contexts and different environments. So I don't think I'd trade it. There have been some long drives across the country, though.
Yeah, it sounds like it. You know, I think that's something that a lot of trainees probably don't appreciate, that you know, once you have a skill set, you're maybe you don't necessarily need to be locked into the same job for 48 years. But I mean, you certainly can, right? But you can move around. And
I tell people when I was in the Bay Area, we don't have this as much here in Portland, but the lateral movement in the San Francisco Bay Area is just crazy. I mean, as long as you're networked and you do good work, you will move laterally. And, you know, four or five years at a place is kind of an eternity down there, often, unless you're a, you know, large, you know, really well-furnished, you know, pharma or something. So, and that always kind of blows people away, you know, when I tell them, you know, that. I think, you know, I do think people have this image of stability. And I think more and more, I think not only in science, but probably in other occupations as well, you will continue to have to evolve yourself and reinvent yourself as you go along. More and more as we go along, things are just moving so quickly. I think we've dealt with that with mass spec instruments, you know, for many years now, but I think people are seeing that in all phases of, you know, jobs now. It's, you can't just sit on your laurels. There's always new things to learn and sort of an adaptation process that you have to go through. Sort of have to embrace it. It's a little scary, but have to embrace it is what I tell people.
Yeah. You know, and I think that it probably helped that you didn't seem to err toward the easier ones, right? So, geez. You know, having dabbled in plants, I always wondered if, like, if all of the methods that, like, for doing protein extraction for plants were all like industry trade secrets, and then to pop over, okay, I'm gonna do top down for a while, right?
yeah. Now it's like, well, all right, this is what the company needs. I will figure this out. That kind of thing I do actually enjoy, like setting up a new method, you know, exploring that method, really finding out what's being done currently, implementing it, and getting it to work. That kind of challenge I really enjoy. So I think those have been fun, but yeah, a little daunting when you start out. Okay, sure. Got no rabbit dog plan in front of me. What do I do?
Right. Yeah.
But in that kind of also, I mean, like you were saying, that jives like with Cedar, right? Like with their structure, and it sounds like their mission, where, like, you know, if you have this fast fail concept, you're changing every year, or, you know, every cycle, right?
Yes.
Changing. I don't mean like you're changing, but you're constantly like looking, you're always like scanning the horizon. You're looking for those opportunities. Like you said, you're applying the technology, like you're always kind of hungry there, right?
I think you've hit it on the head, and there is definitely, you know, a strong attraction of Cedar to, you know, what is the next technology on the horizon? Where are the fields going? I mean, we're not doing just proteomics. There's transcriptomics and genomics. How do we integrate these? You know, all sorts of, you know, analytics being brought on board, machine learning, which I have sort of, you know, deferred to other experts on. I've sort of missed the boat on coding, probably too old for that, or just too old to have been trained well in that. And it's a real shame, because it would be a great skill to have. It's just, there's never enough time to sit down and learn R. I've tried a few times, and I've never had the staying power to
skip it.
Ask ChatGPT. I'm telling you, I'm like, well, you write me this thing, boom, you've leapfrogged. You've waited long enough not to know it that now you don't need to know it.
That's what I'm hoping.
Hate mail,
right?
And I'll take that.
Yeah, that's.
I was able to hire a fantastic colleague who's in the chemistry department at the University of Washington, and he's kind of bootstrapped himself into it, and has really become a great coder. And he knows, you know, he had some experience with mass spec and assay development. So he's been Matthew Chang has been a great right hand man. You know, not only on, you know, he really has taken over the analytic portion of what we do, working. Now he's learning machine learning and for our larger projects and all sorts of stuff. And, you know, I sort of lurk and try to absorb as much as I can. But really, you know, without him, that would be very difficult. Or having a really strong analyst to work hand in hand with, I think that's really important for a proteomics operation. And when we build projects, we absolutely bring in analysts from the beginning. Yeah. I know that Mike McCoss is, you know, at his Skylink course, I did that quite a while ago, but talks about how he had a project, I think it was in rats, and, you know, collected all the data and went to the statistician afterwards. And the statistician was like, oh, I wish you'd talked to me before you had acquired your data. So we absolutely think about powering and, you know, follow Margaret Pepe's probe paradigm for biomarker discovery when we develop those clinical discovery campaigns. And I think, you know, I have probably have not been nearly good enough about that in my past. past, and I think that's something that I've gotten a lot better at.
Did you say Pepe? Right?
Yeah, P-E-P-E.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I know that. Okay, cool.
Yeah, the probe. I never remember what probe stands for. Prospective, retrospective. You know, basically, it's high rigor to, you know, almost applying the rigor that you would apply to a validation study, large scale validation study at the discovery phase, which I think makes a lot of sense.
Absolutely does.
Can I say just one, like, and this is kind of a random one that's are there projects that you feel like, let's say someone's like, hey Mark, I'm going to give you, you know, $2 million for 5 years to do blah. Do you ever kind of like get a little, I don't know, nervous about that in the sense that like you're going to be tied down for that amount of time? I've been trying to figure out like if this is just me. Like sometimes I look at really longer projects and I don't know if I'm just like, I have some issue with commitment, but like you were talking about like how things evolve so fast, right? And if things are always evolving and you just like kind of signed away yourself to 5 years, which is great. It's a job. It's awesome. Do you feel that, or is that just, am I strange?
No, I definitely feel you on that. I think, you know, in our model here, 5 years would be,
like, no,
super scary. Yeah. Like if you're tied to those deliverables and milestones, if you have more of the hunting license models I referenced before, not so much. Cause I think, you know, if you do good science, even if it's a bit different than your initial aims, you can probably, you know, you've maintained your track record. So I think if you have enough flexibility built in, that would be fine with me, but being rigid and long, that's, you know, with deliverables, that would be somewhat scary. Because I think, yeah, it's easy, you know, even in the time that it takes to collect data for a large study now, things can evolve to the point where it's like, yeah, it's too bad we didn't use the next generation or that different acquisition method or the spectral library strategy or whatever. Right? It's like, you know, how are you supposed to keep up with this? Like, yeah, and we've moved pretty quickly. We've partnered with Seer on the study that I'll talk about at HUPO. So they helped us with some of the acquisitions. So we were going quickly, and still, you know, the field is moving pretty quickly in parallel. So yeah, keeping up with instrumentation and just methods, it's challenging for sure.
And you bring up a really good point on sample size, because yeah, I mean, if you're going to do 20,000, well, that's X months, and you can't change in the middle.
Right. I mean,
yeah, like, I don't know, it's a lot.
Unless you have an armada of mass spectrometers, which, you know, at one point, Rudy was talking about, you know, a large scale consortia in the U.S. where you would have just the Borg of instruments and kind of a centralized location for proteomics. Seer was even thinking about that at one point in the early phases of doing that. They have a large set of mass specs, but they were thinking monster. And it's an interesting model because, you know, then, you know, perhaps you could concentrate more on the science, as long as you trusted the people running all those, you know, the Borg of instruments, and, you know, have one instrument for method development, but have the sort of production line go through those, you know, it'd have to be subsidized to make it cost feasible. But that's always something that's rattled around in the back of my head. Is that a better model, you know, than everybody having, you know, three or four mass specs and trying to keep up? Maybe it's better in terms of a competition model of pushing the field forward. It's an interesting things to think about, though. I remember he proposed that, and I don't think it got funded at the time, but it was an interesting model.
Sure. Yeah, no, I think that's something where we're all, I get a little depressed when I see a next generation instrument, right? Because, like, how many people are sitting back there saying, like, hey, I just ran 1,000 samples, but this thing can now do it in half the time, so it's not as impressive.
Yes.
Right. And so
yeah,
we've got some sets sitting here on aging that, you know, really, really big sets. And it's like, oh man, okay, wait, we can actually, should we redo this whole thing? But
right. Right.
Okay. But with all these different angles, Mark, it seems like you're probably in the lab an awful lot, but what do you do when you're not in the lab?
Well, I have a lot of outside hobbies. You know, I enjoy spending time with my partner, Amy, and our dog, James Brown, who I brought back from Cancun at the IHUPO Cancun. I went with Matt, my colleague, to that conference and then headed 5 hours south, almost to Belize, after the conference for a week of scuba diving. Hadn't scuba dived in a long time, but figured if I'm going to go that far, I might as well go do something fun afterwards. went down, had 10 great dives. And unfortunately, we had lost our dog that fall. And this dog just sort of kind of adopted me while I was down there. So brought him back with me, changed my flight, you know, had to make all the arrangements. So Mr. James Brown is a member of the family now, and he kind of reminds me always of Ihupo Cancun as well. I've always been wild. He's a great dog, very silly. I think they know we've always had adoption dogs, and I think they know he always seems grateful to have a couch now to sleep on. He's not sleeping in the jungle with ticks in his ears and so forth. So yeah, no, I was happy to be able to make that happen, and we're lucky to have him.
And importantly, do you have to train him in Spanish, or
he speaks treats. He'll do anything for treats. So probably could get him to speak Spanish if I've had enough treats. So.
Wait, Belize or Mexico?
What's that?
Was it Belize or Mexico?
I was still in Mexico, but it was literally like, I think if you went 20 nautical miles south, you'd be in Belize. You could get a boat ride.
Okay.
I just got the right paperwork.
Okay, so you've got this like Mexican jungle street dog named James,
yes.
James Brown.
He was kind of getting beat up by the other dogs down there. They were having to feed him separately. So it was kind of, you know, he needed a home. The dive awesome. Master was like, yeah, if you take him, he's going to be a great dog. He's not a
sweet dog. All right, cool. Okay, so partner in James Brown.
Yep, and then I like to be on the water a lot. So I kite surf, hydrofoil, did that a lot in the Bay Area. And, you know, one, I'll have to say, draw in addition to science and, you know, area up here was the Columbia River Gorge. So if I'm not here in lab or at home, I'm usually, you know, out on the gorge. Usually Amy's hiking. I'm on the river now hydrofoiling, which is the big thing. Be up on a hydrofoil on your board, holding onto a wing, it's called. Kind of like kiting, kind of like windsurfing, but that's kind of the new technology out there. So you can
Are you kiteboarding, or are you doing the one where like you have the wing that you hold?
I kited for a decade or more, went from a kind of snowboard type board to a surfboard to then a hydrofoil with a kite. And now almost, I would say, boy, 2/3 of people are now on the wings. You don't have to deal with lines.
You're holding on
to something. And yeah.
Well, I'm down in Charleston, and you know we've got pretty decent wind a lot. And
Okay,
we definitely see the hydrofoil, but I've been seeing a lot more of the wings too.
Yeah, my kites are collecting a bit of dust now because I'm winging, you know, pretty much full time now. And even in the winters, I didn't get out this weekend, but a friend texted me, "Oh, you should have been out there on Sunday. It was really good out there." So definitely heavy wetsuit or dry suit territory here in the winter.
Awesome. Okay, that's awesome. I see people like you out there, and I'm just surfing. But
no, sir, that's the purest form. That's the purest form. There's a big community here. I've made a lot of friends, you know, and it's just it's so consistently windy out here from the spring into the fall. So it's a great place for it. And it's a beautiful area to be out there on the river.
Okay. Scientists always have the coolest hobbies, man. I swear, it's you always have to ask, right? But also, right? You're our only person in Portland this season, right? You're a Portland expert.
Oh my gosh!
I don't know. We just got another mass spec member here, and we have the proteomic shared resource. Up on the hill, that's Ashok Reddy and formerly Larry David, although he's in the kind of into retirement now. And then Andrew Emily is one of the organizers for Hupo PDX, and he's just recently moved from the East Coast out to the Knight Cancer Center, so he's here as well now. So we're starting to build a bit more of a proteomics, mass spectrometry proteomics foundation. But I'll have to say, Portland is nothing like, you know, the Bay Area or Seattle or even San Diego, but I think it is, it's on its ascent.
Okay. So for people coming to Portland US Hupo that haven't been there, what can't you miss? We have recognition.
Oh boy, that's a tough one.
Now Parag mentioned the Liège waffles. That was his go-to. And we've got somebody, the other one of note is zoo bombing. So just those are off the table. But you can comment on them. But you can say like, yeah, it's a solid choice.
Like, so yeah, so you know, I'm probably not as highbrow as Parag by any means. I love there's a lot of the food pods with all the food carts. So they're really all over. They generally have fire pits, you know, in the middle. You can get whatever you want in terms of variety. There's usually a beer stand. Portlanders love their coffee and beer. And even sitting outside, even now, they're usually covered. It's not that cold generally here. We went through a cold stretch recently, but not that cold. So sitting outside, there's Blue Star Donuts, which are perhaps some of the fanciest donuts I've ever had. People, you know, the touristy ones are the voodoo donuts, but I like Blue Star. I would say the Blue Star donuts are the ones to go after.
You said a food pod?
The little mobile food carts, kind of like, I remember down in the Bay Area, they would have taco trucks.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like those. They're often, instead of a full truck, they're just kind of the pull behind trailer.
Okay.
And they have everything from, you know, the type of waffles that Parag was talking about, to some of the best barbecue I've had, to, you know, kind of anything you can think of, all sorts of ethnic cuisines. And they're usually all positioned in one place. So it's really nice if you're going with a group of people, you can kind of survey the scene. People can get whatever they want. You're not tied to one necessary, you know, type of food or cuisine. And, you know, then you can all eat together with your different foods. You can even share, have a big fusion fest if you want to and share. So those are, to me, are, you know, something that Portland has a lot of that I love to go to. So I would recommend those. I mean, walking along the river, people will be reasonably close, I guess, kind of close to the Moda Center. I love Blazers games, so you'll be very close to, for Hoopo, to the Moda Center, and the Blazers are in town. If anybody's so inclined, I can't remember exactly who they're playing, but we often have service engineers or visitors come and have been known to take them to Blazers games. So that's always a fun time. The downtown area, I think, Portland it's gotten a bad rap in the news. It's actually a charming place to walk around. There's a lot of good restaurants, a lot of good smaller restaurants, I would say. I live on the other side of the river, so on the east side of the river, and there's a lot of good stuff along Hawthorne, the Clinton Division stretch. Easy to get to. Everything's very close to one another. Lots of good smaller restaurants, bars, pubs, little shops, all sorts of stuff. Northeast has a tremendous amount of stuff too, as well, in the Alberta area, for example.
Okay, so the very first one, me and Google got together, and it told me about these like tunnels. Is that just a made up silly thing? So there's some sort of tunnels down by the river. This is where they would like, you could be Shanghai'd, so you would be like abducted and put to work on. You're looking at me funny. People can't see it. All right, cool. All right, that's good. Good to know. Internet's
boy. Super on top of it. Going down near the river.
Okay, good.
Okay.
It's a fun place. There is this is probably not something that would be easily accessible for Hoopo folks, but we do have two campuses at OHSU. I mentioned I'm on the waterfront campus, which is kind of the newer buildings. And then there's the upper campus, which is the more traditional campus. And there's a gondola that runs between the two. And that particularly, maybe not so much now, or we're into the rainy winter season, but particularly during the fall months when the leaves change. I used to be positioned up there, so I would ride it every day. But I still, sometimes for funds, will ride the gondola when the leaves colors are changing. You can see the volcanoes. You can see Adams, St. Helens, and of course Hood, you know, the easiest to see. And with all the leaf color changes in the river, it's really a nice view from up there. So sometimes I go up to visit our clinical colleagues at the VA. So that's a nice thing to do, you know, as well, just to get a lay of the land as well from a little bit of an elevation point.
I was going to say, I come from a land that is pancake flat. And it actually is always really fun going places where there's mountains. And I keep forgetting, like, the Northwest, like, you just have these, like, distant, giant mountains. And yeah. I haven't seen that in, oh my God, a long time. So I'm pretty excited about that. I keep forgetting.
Well,
that.
Everything's pretty close here. So even getting to Hood is only in, you know, an hour, a little over an hour, Mount Hood. And to get to the Gorge is, I would say, about the same. You can get to Stevenson, where I do a lot of my winging and kiting, from where I am in Southeast, in under an hour. So those are within striking distance, and certainly even just beautiful drives to go out and check out the Columbia River Gorge. Going to Hood River would be a little bit longer drive, but that's a wonderful place to visit. And it's just beautiful in there, you know, even in the winter. I mean, every time I'm out there, I see ospreys, almost always see an eagle. There's literally salmon flopping around when we're riding in the river. You know, it's really a beautiful place out there. I love being out there.
Cool.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. No, it's funny that this very positive thing to end, you know, either our last episode or next.
I think this is about the last.
But with all these suggestions for Portland, for, you know, people.
Oh, great. Well, I look forward to having everybody here in Portland. Yeah.
And finally having someone to confirm or deny, like, some of these things.
Okay. So the way we like to, we're wrapping up this series is just asking people, you know, Mark, what are you most excited about in terms of where proteomics is going right now? Like, what do you think's, yeah, the thing that gets you excited about the future here with us?
I think, you know, we're at a real sort of explosion point in proteomics in many ways. I mean, I think we've seen sort of these incremental increases in instrumentation coming from the mass spec side, dominated by Thermo and then more recently by Bruker. And they're kind of, you know, going back and forth with their you know, ion mobility and Astral and so forth instruments with, you know, I think step function gains now and performance. I think the next wave will be, you know, these single molecule sequencing platforms. And there's some work here on those. Certainly Parag, you know, having founded Nautilus, QuantumSci, you know, there's a whole gamut now, I think, vying to develop that technology. Some very recent articles on several nanopore approaches. That, to me, I think is going to unlock some of the things that mass spec can't do. I think, you know, single cell at, you know, extraordinary depth potentially. And overcoming, you know, depending on the platform, a lot of the peptide to protein roll-up issues that we have to deal with computationally. I don't know if I'll see that in my time. You know, I'm over 50 now, so, you know, how fast those will come out. But certainly, even if I'm not a practicing proteomic person, I certainly think I'll probably see that technology employed. And I'm very interested to see how that revolutionizes things. You know, I think that's going to be a real game changer in many ways. And it'll be interesting to see kind of which of those many suitors wins out in that race to, you know, sort of get the first commoditized platform to market. So that's something I'm certainly following. I think there's a lot more these days of affinity reagent-based platforms. I do worry a little bit about those in terms of reagent specificity and losing proteoform diversity potentially. So I do think they're easy to use and they're much less daunting for users than mass spec is. So they're very attractive. I do caution people on those. I think, you know, I'm not saying they don't work and they're not excellent platforms, but I do caution people, you know, you are beholden to whatever panel that you're analyzing and whatever affinity reagents that are being used for that panel. So just definitely something to keep in mind. So I think, yeah, we have a lot of options these days. And we're seeing, I think, kind of an explosion, as I said, of these technologies. It's an exciting time in proteomics.
That was a great answer. And I think it's been surprising as we've done, you know, 40 of these shows or whatever we're at now, how many times the single molecule thing has come up, right? The excitement here for that. So, but no, that's great. Omar, I'm running out of time, so thank you for joining us. This was a lot of fun.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a lot of fun for me too.
Cool. Yes. So the credits. So first off, the views expressed are solely ours and not our employers or US HUPO. We want to thank US HUPO for sponsoring this series. We want to thank Johannes for the intro and exit song, Kaylee Kirkwood for the artwork. You can email us, and you should, at theproteomicshow@gmail.com. Please like, subscribe, give stars, thumbs up, other things. And yeah, bye. All right. Hi. We're back. If you're still listening at this point, sorry. So we were in the studio and we found John Yates around. Hey, John.
Hey, morning.
So we had you on back in May of 2023. It's now January. Before you were the pre-president. I don't know. What do you call it? President-elect.
Incoming president, maybe?
Incoming president.
President-elect. President-elect
of USU PO. Now you're an actual president, and then you'll be a past president. And then they just let you out to pasture, right, at that point?
So you do that for a year, and then you're each year?
So we've already elected a new president-elect. So I think that's a year, and then president a year, and then past president a year, I think.
Yeah.
I had argued when we were redoing the bylaws, I had argued that we should make it 2 years. Like the ASMS model.
Like 2 years as a current, or 2 years for each of those three things?
2 years is each of those things.
Cool.
I'm really big on the idea of institutional memory. Yeah. So having people around that, you know, that so we don't keep trying to readdress the same issue over and over again.
Yeah. I like it a lot. Okay, wait, hold on. Before we actually talk something, do you remember Hidden Tracks? I know we talked about like the 90s. You were just like in the lab, you know, creating proteomics. But like, do you remember Hidden Tracks? Was that a thing for you?
No. And, you know, I also totally missed out on that, you know, play the Beatles record, Abbey Road record backwards and says Paul McCartney is dead sort of thing. Yeah. I didn't get that either.
So, well, I was, as this morning when I was coming, I was trying to think about, like, I don't think you had Hidden Tracks on records because that would have been kind of wasteful, but maybe, I'm sure someone could correct me, but CDs in the land of CD time. You would have this, like, the last track, like normally they were like 10 tracks and the last track, and it would just be like, it wouldn't ever stop. So you'd have the final song and then it'd just be like 15 minutes and then there'd be a thing. So I remember, I know Black Keys album, which that was like the 2000s. They had a really good one. I feel like Green Day had one. I know Ben Osborne, you knew.
Oh yeah. Track. Yeah. There's a really disturbing one at the end of the first Slipknot album. It goes on for a long time and then there's a lot of people vomiting and something really, really terrible happens.
But it would always catch people off guard because if you had your CD playing, you just like think it was just quiet, and then it would just like catch you off guard. So that's what this poor idea came from. I think there's a small period of history that knows Hidden Tracks. I've actually think they've gone and like changed them so they don't have Hidden Tracks like on the digital versions.
They don't still sell CDs, do they?
Yeah.
Sort of.
They sell like cassettes now. I mean, if they sell cassettes and records, surely they sell CDs.
I don't know. I had a CD player very early on. I was newly married and that was the like first Christmas present that my wife gave me was a little portable CD player. Mm. I hooked it up to my boombox in the lab, and so after hours I would be cranking out.
Wait, what are you cranking out to? What is John Yates, young John, in the lab? What are you jamming to?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what were some of my first albums. I know I bought some classical CDs, you know, because the sound quality was supposed to be so much better.
Yeah.
You know, I may have had a Madonna CD back then.
Okay. What are we talking like 90s still or like?
No, I'm talking about 80s.
We're 80s? You had a CD player in the 80s?
1985.
Whoa. That's really fancy. Okay. I'm a child of 1981, so mine would have been, you had these like things where you could get like 10 CDs for free. It was like BMG and they were like always the same 10 CDs. Like, you know what I'm talking about, Osborne, right?
Yeah.
But you could get them, but then you had to cancel or else you kept getting all these weird CDs in the mail.
Yes. So those music clubs or album clubs or something. Yeah. I remember those. I never signed up for one.
Oh, I did. That was it was like that and like used CDs. That's where I got all my music from. Okay. So back on track though, we actually had a real reason. So when we had you on back in May, we talked to you for a while, but we got off the show and Ben Osborne was like, oh my gosh, I forgot to ask him about, what was it, Ben?
Yeah, I think, yeah. And it's funny because you brought that up and then I was like, wait, I have to dig up my notes from the episode. But yeah, no, so, I think it was malaria stuff. Right. Because I don't think we ever got to that. And you know, I think that, you know, just given where I came from, the mud pit falciparum stuff was when I started seeing your lab stuff. Right. And I guess the big question is, I forgot the question, what it was at the time, but
well, how'd you get that project certainly has such a great story associated with it. I was talking about proteomics at a conference and some guy comes up to me and says, can I talk to you about this project I'm thinking about? As it was a guy named Dan Carucci. Turns out he was a lieutenant colonel or something in the military. He was in civilian clothes at the time. But his specialty was tropical medicine, and he was at, I think it's something in Rockville, Tropical Medicine Institute, the Navy's Tropical Medicine Institute or something.
Sure, yeah.
And he was a flight surgeon, MD, but his specialty was tropical diseases. And he says, I'm organizing the sequencing of the Plasmodium falciparum genome. And this technology looks like it's something that we could use as sort of the next step. And so we got together and talked about it and got some funding. I never had more than enough funding for like a postdoc out of that project. And Mike Washburn started on that project. It was about the time, you know, it wasn't too long after we had started developing it. Mike had published his paper on the mud pit process in yeast. And so Mike took on this project, and he knew this was going to be a grand slam project. And so he was really keen on working on it. And then I announced I was going to move to San Diego. And interestingly, so I'm going to announce I'm moving to San Diego from University of Washington on a Friday. Mike comes in to the lab on Wednesday. Hey, I just bought a house.
No.
In Seattle.
No.
And it's like, well, that complicates things a bit. And so I wanted to get the whole lab to move down to San Diego. And I was going to take two jobs. So I was going to have a job at this Novartis-funded research institute, which was for there were two. There was one, the human side, and then there was one for the ag side. And so I gave Mike the choice. You could go to Scripps, continue to work on the malaria project, and but you know, there's really no money to help you offset this new problem that you've just developed with buying a house. But you know, if you go to the Novartis Agricultural Discovery Institute, they'll have relocation packages and they'll help, you know, selling this house and buying a new house and all this kind of stuff. So it was real dilemma for him to figure out what to do.
Sure.
And so his solution to it was he's going to move to the Discovery Institute, but I have to hire his wife, Laurence Florenz, to work on the malaria project. And at that point I hadn't met Laurence, didn't know anything about her. And so I said, because I really wanted Mike to move. It was clear that Mike was going to be a mover and a shaker. And so, so I said, sure, okay, I'll hire her. And so I finally met her and she came down and she turned out to be like the best postdoc I've ever had. She was just awesome. So she took that malaria project by the horns and wrestled it to the ground and just did fantastic work on it. I mean, there was the Plasmodium falciparum version, but there was also Yoeli-Lai, and so we've like worked on every single version of malaria that people study in the lab. And she, through Dan Carucci wound up being a fantastic collaborator, and through Dan we got integrated into other people that were involved in the malaria research field. And so Laurence was collaborating with all these people, and she published like 30 papers, you know, on malaria, something like that. She's like one of my most productive postdocs.
And you had no idea who she was. It just kind of was this weird thing that happened, and then that was the deal, and then boom.
Yeah, and you know, before Mike bought the house, he had come in, you know, was working in the lab, and then he disappeared one weekend. And then he comes back on Monday and says, "Hey, I got married." and it turned out, so his wife is, so Laurence is French, and they met in grad school, and they, you know, were dating and all that kind of stuff. And then her visa was about to end up. And so they had a quickie marriage. And then when she came, she moved to San Diego, and they had to go through that process. Have you ever seen the movie The Proposal, or one with long time ago with Gerard Depardieu, The Green Card, where you have to go through this interview process to show that you're really married? And so they had to start doing that. And that was, they came back with some pretty funny stories about the kind of questions they were going to ask, get asked.
Was it the ones like where it's like, what is your partner's favorite color? And you're like,
yeah,
Paisley.
You know, what color toothbrush kind of thing.
Oh my gosh. And they're like, we got married by Elvis. We have no idea. No, I'm joking. That's not, if they're listening, no.
We met in a bar in Vegas and we got married.
I mean, it happens. That's incredible. You know, it's funny, you know, I think you listen to the show, right? There's all these like random stories about how people get to where they get, but I don't know. I mean, so this person turns into, and that's what I always think too, is like, so this person writes how many papers? And it's like such a, like a tour de force.
So she wrote like, I don't remember the exact number, but it's like 30 papers. What was remarkable about her is that she basically published every piece of data she ever collected.
Nice.
She was continuing to submit papers, you know, a couple of years after, 2 years after she left the lab.
Yeah,
so it was pretty remarkable.
Yeah, I went to and visited Mike's lab.
And you probably met Laurence.
I did, yeah, and I definitely fanboyed really hard on that because I had read so much of her stuff when I was, you know, at NIAID. It was just like, you know, I'm trying to do malaria proteomics, and it's like, oh, okay, well, here's all the guidance, right? So, appreciated those papers a lot, and it's a miserable organism to work with. It just really, truly is. So.
So we were working with I think the sequencing was being done at the Sanger Center. So they would come up with a new, so they collected all the data and it was a, you know, AT rich genome, and they were all used to GC rich genomes. And so they were trying to figure out the coding sequences and stuff like that. And so every week they would send us a new interpretation of the database, and Laurence would dutifully search all of her data through it, and she would start telling them, you know, what proteins appeared and what proteins disappeared, you know, all these kind of things. So it was really, actually the proteomic data was actually quite useful to helping them sort out what were genes and what weren't genes.
Yeah. And it's funny because I, you know, just looking at it now, it hasn't improved much since then. right? Like I go to the PlasmoDB database, and it's still like the old, you know, there's a point around 2014, 15 where they just stopped putting a lot of data into it. It seems like they really kind of, it got to that point, and there was this whole flurry of activity, right? Where they built lots and lots. There's all these protein sequences. I think a lot of them, or probably the vast majority, came from you guys. And then it's one of those things that kind of, it plateaued. And that's.
Right. It probably depends on, I mean, you should look to see if it's still funded. Because NIH does not like to fund databases per se. But, you know, they're happy to get them started, but they don't want to sustain them. And so they're always looking for ways to get out of having funded these things. So if you ever decide to build a database, you probably need to think about long-term sustainability
in some fashion. That's a good point.
And then in the U.S., the NIH doesn't fund a lot of malaria medicine. Most of the money that came from the malaria projects came out of the military, because they're interested in it, because they send people into areas where malaria is endemic.
I never would have guessed that at all.
And that's like, I mean, you know, Magnus Pomblad at Enlighten is, you know, to hear about all the tropical disease work, and then it takes you a second and you're like, oh wait, they were like in Indonesia. You know, like, you know, you had these like colonial powers that were in all these weird places. And so, of course, like, they did huge research.
Exactly. That's where the interest comes from for a lot of these countries in Europe for this. Yeah.
Old school imperial, like, watch out for Legionnaire's disease or whatever. That's all right. That's.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the spread of Islam through Africa, comes basically down to the malaria line in Africa, and then they go no farther, because they can't get around the fact that people are getting sick from malaria, and so, you know, just get to a certain point in Africa.
There's a recent book that's really, really great where they track some of the malaria variants and put this argument forth that that's why Rome was so indestructible, because everyone that would try to come in and tackle Rome would get wiped out by malaria that everyone in Rome was already immune to had high resistance to. So you could never cross those plains into Rome, and that's why it stood for so long. That's a really, really compelling argument.
If you think about it, it's a pretty remarkable organism, because its genome is about the size of Saccharomyces cerevisiae, and it's got these four or five different morphological stages, and it goes through two different organisms. And so it's a pretty remarkable organism.
Yeah, absolutely. And miserable to work with.
So the people I've known that work with them, they have to have their mosquito cages, and then they have to feed the mosquitoes. And so they put their arms inside the cages and let the mosquitoes feed on live blood.
Yeah, and we had postdocs at NIAID that would just spend all day like just taking out salivary glands from mosquitoes, because they would have to get, it takes a lot of salivary glands from a lot of mosquitoes to get to enough for an LTQ valus to be able to see any peptides. Right.
Yes, absolutely.
I
developed a lot of respect for people that were able to do that.
They do this funny thing here where you can go in for different malaria drug trials, and everyone I know that's went in and done it. And you get a lot of money to get infected with malaria and try different drugs. But every person I've known that's ever done it has ended up getting malaria really bad and then just missing a ton of work. And then, so actually they, even though like the trials will pay like $3,000 or $4,000, they lose money because they just miss so much work.
And they have malaria. And it doesn't seem like a good choice.
Yeah.
Malaria does kill people.
It certainly does. Yeah.
Yeah. Like millions.
Hey, if you go take this drug and get bit by, stick my arm in this thing and, maybe I'll work for a month. Yeah, never personally done it. But. Okay. So that was my question.
Right. Yeah.
John, we're glad you were still here.
Thanks.
Just wandering around
the studio, the proteomics show. Well, hey, John, before we leave, you know, we are going to see you in Portland.
Yeah.
Which coming up.
Game to play when we see you. So this stuff is so cool.
Looking forward to the lightning talks and seeing the originality that people are going to exhibit when I give their talks. I'm working on something.
Oh, you are?
Awesome.
Yes.
That's better than abstract.
Yes. I'm going to push the boundaries again a little bit and see what happens.
That, I can't wait.
Yeah, I mean, that's because we have like 2 days, right? And so, 2 days of lightning talks? It'll be really good.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we had
more requests for lightning talks than we really had time for. So,
wow. Okay.
So they're becoming very popular.
Yeah.
Because they're awesome.
Yeah. Was it John Price that he's constantly talking his students off of pyrotechnics? Nope, can't do that.
Should I light someone on fire? No. Teacher cannon? Yes. I think they're actually just anchoring it, right? They're like, if they make it crazy enough, it'll be like, yeah, you should dress up like Shamu. Why not? All right, cool. All right. Well, I think we're going to wrap it up because we've piggybacked on, I believe, Mark Florey's show. So we'll thank Mark for letting us do that. John, thank you for making time with us again. Real fast, we still need to say the views expressed are solely ours and not our employers or US Hupo. And thank everyone again, Johannes for the song, Kayla Kendall for the artwork, US Hupo for sponsoring us. And we'll see everyone in Portland. All right, cool. Bye.
Okay. All right. Bye-bye.